Hello and welcome to episode 28 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. Today is the 28th of February 2023. My name is Rebecca Thompson and I wrote the first investigation into the Post Office Horizon IT scandal for Computer Weekly in 2009. I'm doing the introduction all by myself today because my co-host Nick Wallace did the main interview for this episode, a conversation with Dan Needle. Dan is a tax lawyer and founder of the Tax Policy Associates, a think tank set up to better explain tax, a subject which he is passionate about. Dan is perhaps best known for prompting the sacking of Conservative Party chairman Nadeem Zahawi, who structured one of his companies in a way designed to avoid the payment of tax, tried to pretend he hadn't, and then threatened to sue people like Dan who are asking questions about it. Dan then turned his attention to the Post Office scandal. In this interview, he explains how and why he got drawn in. Nick and Dan cover his career, what a tax lawyer actually does, something called a slap lawsuit, the Nadeem Zahawi episode, and of course, the problems with the Post Office compensation schemes, including Dan's concerns that postmaster compensation has been assessed unfairly. Andy says there's a danger that without specialist advice, a lot of sub-postmasters could find themselves being pursued by HMRC long after they receive compensation. The interview was recorded yesterday on Monday the 27th of February, the same day the Post Office wrote a letter to the Times responding to Dan's Saturday op-ed column. You can hear what he makes of that and much more in the interview. I'll be back afterwards to say goodbye, but for now, here's Nick talking to Dan Needle.
Dan, first of all, thank you very much for joining us. I think most people will have an inkling of who you are, but just give us an idea as to your background as a tax lawyer.
I qualified as a lawyer back in 2000. At a very large international law firm. I became a partner in 2008, just in time for the financial crisis, and I ended up as head of tax at my firm, which is fantastic. I loved being a lawyer. I loved working at my firm, surrounded by great people, doing good work for great clients. Tax lawyers are not the evil tax avoidance scheme generators that many people think. At some point I should probably write about what exactly it is tax lawyers do. But
can you give us an inkling? I mean, what do tax? I mean, what accountants do? What's the difference between an accountant, a tax accountant, and a tax lawyer?
In a sense, there's no answer to that because a tax accountant can do most of the things a tax lawyer does, and some tax lawyers have a practice very similar to accountants. But my practice, what I did, was rather different. Certainly, I don't need to have been hugely ethical to not have spent time designing tax avoidance schemes because those schemes, on the kind of scale that my clients would have been interested in, stopped being a thing around the time that I qualified as a lawyer. I would have been astonishingly negligent if I'd gone to a client and said, hey, I've got an amazing tax avoidance scheme that will save you a bunch of money. And if I had, they would have laughed me out the room. So, no, that's not what I did. Most of what tax lawyers do, you can probably divide into two parts. Part of it is tax litigation, where you are normally acting for a client against HMRC. And the cases that I was involved in were essentially technical disagreements on the law. Surprise, surprise, the HMRC's technical view was that more tax should be paid, and my client's technical view was that less tax would be paid. But they were tricky technical disputes, and it was the highly technical nature that meant that I was involved. So that was part of what I did. The other main thing that tax lawyers do is tax risk. In other words, you are buying a UK company. When you buy that company, you are then responsible for everything in it, for good and for bad. And if it turns out they've done some really bad tax stuff, either deliberately or accidentally, you own that. You bought it. You've got to deal with it. So you'd rather find out before you bought it. So a very common tax lawyer thing is looking at a company structure and working out whether the tax makes sense.
So part of it is basically doing due diligence on a business deal before it happens. And
due diligence isn't quite right. The due diligence tends to be more what the accountants do, pulling up the books, going through the accounts. I'd more be looking at discrete points that someone has seen and gone, this doesn't seem quite right. Let's get Dan involved. Or the flip side of that, actually doing the structuring. You're taking over a company. How do you take it over in a way that's compliant with, and we can go through a list, kind of employment law, company law, pension law, environmental law, corporate law, tax law, multiply those across all the countries in which the company operates. Getting something that works for all of those is really, really hard. Often impossible. You're trying to do the least worst structure. And so that kind of jigsaw assembly and putting together is a large part of what tax lawyers like me did. What that does is it makes you much better at doing that kind of due diligence role of examining someone else's structure. It also means that I've ended up quite by accident being very well trained in how to investigate structures that someone else has done, someone like Mr. Zahawi.
Right, so take me through setting up Tax Policy Associates. When did you do that and why?
So I had a pretty boring, cliched pandemic realisation that I should look at my priorities. And I was lucky enough to be in a position where I didn't need to work anymore. Absurdly privileged, really. And I love my job. But if I'm working very hard and quite long hours at a job that I don't need to do, and so not spending time with my family, I'm doing that because I enjoy it. I don't have a job at all. I've got a hobby. And I've got an extremely selfish and all-consuming hobby. And I decided that that was not the right choice. So I decided to retire, which came as a shock to my colleagues and clients, but I think by now they've well got over it and forgotten me. And then it was just, what do I do? Do I tend to my tomatoes and my family and become a gentleman of leisure? Well, no, that I was never going to do that. I have this tax knowledge, I have these contacts, and there's lots of things that annoy me about the way tax is discussed and not discussed in the public discourse. And I thought I could stick my oar in and try and make a small difference. And I also thought that I could provide... I've always talked to journalists and policymakers behind the scenes. I thought I could do that on a more formal basis. So the idea of Tax Policy Associates was to do both those things, to be a vehicle for me providing tax policy advice to policymakers and journalists, and also for me to operate like a one-man think tank, collaborate with all the people I know across the tax world, identify tax problems, tax issues, areas where tax policy has failed, and try and shift the public debate on that.
Did you go looking for a high-profile target to raise awareness of your organisation when it came to Nadeem Zahawi, or did it fall into your lap by accident?
I am not that smart. No. So I started out in May 2022, and I was speaking to policymakers and all four political parties and journalists, and then writing the odd piece. And someone suggested I look at Jeremy Hunt. They said there's this Tory leadership campaign coming up. Hunt's going to be a strong candidate. He sold his company, made a lot of money, and I think he avoided tax. And I took a look at it, and in about 30 seconds saw, no, he hasn't avoided tax at all. He's held his company in a very straightforward way. He probably could have done some things to reduce his tax, and he didn't. So good for him. So I said that. And then there were a couple more like that where I think the Jeremy Hunt one I did put on the website. There were others that I didn't put on the website because I thought the accusations were so unfair that it was just giving more oxygen to it. Rees-Mogg I probably should have done because it seems to still be going round on Twitter, people thinking Rees-Mogg's avoided tax in a couple of specific ways which are wrong. And then there was this article in The Independent that Zahawi had been the subject of an HMRC investigation and also a National Crime Agency investigation. But no one knew what about.
And was this when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer?
It was just at the time he was appointed.
Just as
he was appointed. And I thought, that's interesting. And so I started digging around, and often... And I think this is common for anyone who's used to looking at anything. So you as a journalist will be familiar with it. You see something that makes you go, huh, that's really strange. And you do that quite quickly. That's an intuition. Then actually following up to check your intuition is correct and find that exactly what the strangeness is, that takes quite a long time. But the initial intuition's a fast thing. So what started as me thinking it would be a 30-minute style Jeremy Hunt, this is straightforward type of work, it ended up being at least a week's work of delving into Zahawi's arrangements with YouGov, finding out that something was indeed up, and then writing about it. I thought it was a nice story, but I thought that would be the end of it. I had not the slightest clue it would blow up in the way it did.
And forgive me, we ought to just say for people who aren't completely familiar with this, Nadeem Zahawi, Chancellor of the Exchequer, Conservative politician, but also set up or his father set up YouGov, is that right?
Sorry, he set up YouGov.
He set up YouGov.
Amazing achievement. He was one of the two founders of a company which is now the world leader in opinion polling. And it's amazing. He deserves a pile of credit for it. But the way that he did it was, I always thought, clearly designed to avoid tax, but also clearly didn't work. So he clearly owed a bunch of tax.
And so the way he did what exactly? The selling of the company?
When you set up a company, you typically hold founder shares. Those are the shares which initially are worth kind of nothing, but if the company becomes a success, they'll be worth a lot. And his business partner held founder shares in the way you'd expect, but Zahawi held no founder shares. Instead, a Gibraltar company, which I was able to prove was held by a trust owned by Zahawi's parents, held the founder shares you'd think he would have got.
And why is that problematic?
Well, if I give you some shares, that isn't tax avoidance. You'll then get the dividend and income on those shares. I won't pay tax on them because, you know, fair enough, they're not mine. But if I give you some shares and then you arrange for your dividends and gains on the shares to be paid back to me and you're offshore, suddenly I have tried to avoid tax, because my aim in doing that is that I still get the money, but by sticking you in the middle of the transaction, I'm paying no tax. And that's
this was
what
all
he'd done.
And he'd done this, using Nick, presumably well before he became a government minister.
He did it back in 2000.
Before he became a Conservative MP.
He did it in 2000 when he was really very young. And probably that explains why the tax planning was so bad. But the big money on these shares came in 2017, 2018, when he was a senior MP. He was an experienced businessman. And at that point, he really should have declared them to HMRC or got tax advice, but it seems he didn't. He got over £20 million on these shares, didn't declare it, didn't pay tax on it.
So when did the HMRC and the NCA become interested in this?
Well, we still don't know the details. When I was writing about this, I thought that I'd actually found something different, because I thought, surely the NCA isn't interested in some founder shares. It's much too trivial for them. I've found something else. I need to make a noise about this, and then I'm sure HMRC will investigate it. And so when he started pushing back and denying it and setting lawyers to send letters ordering me to back off, I thought that's because he was worried this would blow up and HMRC would investigate him. Little did I know, HMRC had already investigated him, and he was in the middle of negotiations with HMRC. He was getting lawyers to send me letters denying there was anything wrong when he knew there was something wrong. I was in the middle of settling it. I still find that hard to believe.
And by this stage, he was chairman of the Conservative Party, and we are into, 2022?
When he was writing me the letters, I've been a bit murky on the timeline. I started looking at this in July 2022 when he became Chancellor. The rude lawyer letters came also in July 2022. My investigation then continued past September, when he ceased to be Chancellor, became chairman of the Conservative Party. And then it all blew up spectacularly in January of this year, when The Sun had a scoop that he had in fact settled this with HMRC. And I had originally estimated he had 3.7 million of tax that maybe hadn't been paid. It turned out he had settled for 3.7 million of tax.
So this is, an extraordinary story, and I think every single journalist who was reading along with this was incredibly, I think, professionally jealous of the brilliance you applied to this, and also cheering you on from the sidelines, because the threats of being sued are a sort of occupational hazard for people like us on a daily basis. And the way that you were very clearly able to just say, well, no, this is all a bit silly and all a bit wrong, I'm simply doing my job, was, I think, brilliantly articulated in the national media, and it gave other journalists succour to keep pursuing this. But also, there was this thought of why does it take a tax policy think tank to go for the jugular on this? What is it that journalists are missing here? Is it the lack of knowledge about tax law? Is it this fearfulness, but the chilling effect that threats of defamation can have? Or is it that simply we're not good enough at doing what you were doing?
Well, it's inevitably the case that no journalist is an expert on particle physics or environmental law or gambling or any of the things that they write about, and tax law is no different from that. And what I found didn't take a lot of tax expertise. I'm pretty confident there are thousands of tax people who, looking at what I saw, would have seen the issue. And yeah, the support I had from tax people was pretty astonishing. How many tax advisors are there in the country? And how many of those did Sahawi get to say, oh, no, this is fine, there's nothing going on here? None. It was really clear-cut for a tax person. But it's something a journalist probably couldn't have found. What this possibly the slight ball dropping was, years before, I think in 2018, The Guardian had a piece where they spotted the existence of the Stapleton Company and that it held the shares. But they did one of the things which prompted me to found Tax Policy Associates. They saw that there was an offshore element and they thought that that was the thing. They thought, it's really naughty, he's used an offshore company. And that's not really the story. If you see an offshore company, the question is that a legitimate use of an offshore company? Is it a legal but perhaps immoral tax avoidance use of an offshore company? Or is it in fact a case where someone's tried to put money offshore, but the UK is still going to tax it because they've messed up? And this was actually the third of those cases. But because that 2018 article kind of stopped at the superficial point, it didn't really explore and find what was really going on. And possibly at that point, they could have spoken to tax people and could have worked out what was going on. So perhaps there are very few professionals who are able to speak out openly the way I am, because they're employed. But there's quite a lot of retired HMRC officials out there and quite a lot of tax people who can speak off the record. So I think if a journalist finds something that involves offshore, finds something that involves tax, then it would be great if they would reach out to tax people. I don't want to sound bitchy about this, because the fundamental point is something that only a tax lawyer or tax accountant would have spotted. But I think there were signs that could have prompted someone to get a tax lawyer or tax accountant involved.
And your eureka moment was what you mentioned earlier, that you realised that the shares were being held by Zahawi's parents.
It wasn't just that. It was that, so he was always claiming it wasn't tax avoidance, it was a commercial arrangement. But when you look, you see that actually the Gibraltar Company got the shares for free. They, not only did they get it for free, but there were a couple of tells that dodginess was going on. One was that when your company issues shares to someone, it says what the thing was that they provided that got them the shares. So if you pay £100 for shares, it will say he paid £100. And Zahawi's business partner, Stephen Shakespeare, he got the shares, and it said he got the shares in return for the work that he'd done to found the company. Fair. The Gibraltar Company, it said it got the shares for the work that it had done to found the company. Huh? It's a company. So that looks to me like it was going to say Zahawi, and at the last minute they changed the name to the Gibraltar Company, but forgot to paper properly the reason why it was getting the shares.
How interesting.
And then the second funny is that 2 years later, they created a form backdated to the date the shares were issued, saying that £7,000 was paid for the shares, which was their nominal value. And that again looked like something odd had happened, which they were trying to paper properly.
The secondary element to this, which you've already touched on, is the threats that you were getting, which does seem... I don't know, you tell me, how unusual behaviour is it when you're investigating someone who is a very senior politician, i.e. a public figure, for them to start throwing around threats of defamation action against you? Did it ever get worrying to you, or did you just think, well, this is clearly ludicrous and a sign that something's up?
Well, it was a situation I was not remotely used to. I'm very familiar with litigation. I'd never been personally sued by someone or threatened to be sued for defamation. So when I originally got the threat, I was shocked that it was issued. I'm a very bad person to sue, because I don't have an editor who can hold me back. I have financial resources. I have time. Not only am I familiar with litigation, but I enjoy litigation. And I have a virtual Rolodex full of lawyers, accountants, and other people who are happy to help me out. So it was a bad mistake to threaten to sue me. It was still initially something that I took very seriously, because the way our libel system works, if he sues me, it costs him a tiny fraction of his supposed 100 million wealth. If I win, it will still cost me a few hundred grand in costs I won't get back. If I lose, I could be £2 or 3 million out. And that's an astonishing risk to take. And my wife and I thought about it extremely carefully and decided, first of all, that we thought that I was right. But second, more important, we thought that he would never actually want to sue, because that would mean he'd have to disclose his tax planning and he'd be cross-examined by a KC. And we thought that would be difficult for him. Little did we know quite how difficult it would be. If we'd known what he was actually doing at that time, we would have just giggled hysterically at the letter we received. So there was that. There was also the fact that his letter, the lawyer letters, were just a bit odd. They were strangely worded, didn't quite take on what I'd said, didn't quite deny completely what he'd done, and it made me feel he was hiding something. I didn't understand what it was he was hiding, but yeah. I thought he was hiding something.
It's really interesting because I think it is a live issue, these slaps. Was it strategic litigation against public participation?
Yes.
Is that what it stands for? Yeah.
Did you ever get one for your post office work?
Well, I received several letters from several law firms representing several different individuals and organisations. But this was, I think, pretty normal stuff for the world that I operate in. I didn't ever feel threatened. Although there were threats, what would you call them, threats? There were allusions to potential action if certain things about what I was writing wasn't changed in some way. But I took a lot of that to be part of the right of the reply process and the extreme sensitivity of the people involved as to their reputations, etc. So you
Did
could
you
argue
say
that
things in those letters which turned out not to be true.
What they were very good at is pointing out things which I was not necessarily asserting, but asking them about, which they were just full of flat denials. So you could say, well, this is part of the editorial process. You're writing a book. You say, I think this is the case. Is that true or not? And they say, it's very much not true. And were you to print that, we would sue you. And if you haven't got any contrary evidence, then you don't print it. If you do have contrary evidence, then you just note the fact that they are denying it. And that's.
But did they say that about something which turns out to be really clearly true?
Not with my book, no. I mean, okay. I think earlier on, when my work for the BBC was attracting lawyers' letters over the post office scandal, there were assertions about the robustness of the Horizon system which were demonstrably false, and only turned out to be demonstrably false after the Horizon judgment came through in 2019. But
have you made this? Sorry, I'm asking you all these questions.
No,
made
it's
those
fine.
Letters
it's,
available
it's,
to the inquiry.
Well, the argument is that we've had from the post office is that the people who were writing those letters and making those assertions sincerely believed what they were saying was true. And that is something that I think will have to get bottomed out in the inquiry. I mean, there's a particular moment in the very first panorama that we did where we were trying to drag the post office to the plate for an interview over an extended period of time, and eventually the only thing they would agree to is an on the record background briefing, during which three senior an on the record background briefing. So
is that like a black shade of white?
It's an extraordinary situation, and it is one that obviously my colleagues had to think, I didn't take part in it, it's one that my colleagues had to think very hard about agreeing to. But the fact it was on the record meant that whatever the post office decided to say to us in that meeting, we could then use in our programme. But it wasn't an interview. So one of the things that the three senior executives who they sent along to that meeting insisted was that Horizon was robust, and at no time had the post office or Fujitsu ever had the opportunity to open it up and delve into individual sub-postmasters' accounts. That was untrue. But when this came out in the High Court litigation, the argument was that the three senior executives in 2015 who said that on the record to Panorama sincerely believed that to be the case.
So had someone lied to them?
Either someone lied to them, or so, you know, it's who knew what when, and who lied to whom when. And
but if they didn't ask the right people, then that's on them. And if they did ask the people and those people lied to them, then
Yeah, then that should be bottomed out by the inquiry, because we need to know who misadvised those three post office executives so that they were able to deliver a blatant untruth to the country's premier current affairs programme. Because by that stage, and certainly what has come out in the inquiry to date, is that there was a significant amount of corporate knowledge as to the lack of robustness of Horizon and the ability for Fujitsu and post office people to go and delve into postmaster accounts. How that didn't reach the three people who will have been briefed to go and speak to Panorama on the record is a mystery, which we'll hopefully get to the bottom of. So around that time, the post office was sending legal letters telling journalists and their editors that Horizon was robust, and anyone questioning that was potentially falling foul of future unspecified legal action.
Did you ever get a letter from those same lawyers apologising, withdrawing what they
said? No, and also the letters, don't forget, were sent to my editors rather than me personally, and it was all along the lines of, you know, I think you've got a stray journalist barking up the wrong tree here. You know, he's going to make you look pretty bad when he's.
This is why I say I had an advantage not having editors.
Absolutely, and the editors. Well, an advantage for you, and I'm pretty much in the same position as you with what I write and what I do nowadays. But in those days, my editors were very good at protecting me. They just said, "Go do your journalism. We'll worry about this lot." So that in that respect, it did help. But yeah, I mean, there is some interest in the inquiry as to exactly what these legal letters that other journalists and I were getting, and what they may or may not have threatened, and whether this will come into discussion. To be honest, I've never been worried about a legal threat, because I do remember very, very early on the legend that goes around the newsroom of one grizzled old editor who saw some junior hack had received a legal threat and telling him that these are the Oscars of our profession, young man. you get on and do what you're doing. So, you know, it is obviously a theoretical risk, but I've always seen it actually as to some degree helpful with the editorial process. And if someone is screaming blue murder and threatening that they are going to sue you because, you know, you can sniff that there's something up here, there is an element of me that just says, okay, bring it on, let's see what happens, because I think what I'm doing is in the public interest. But it is, you know, I have developed a pretty sort of stiff neck about this. I can imagine how individual citizens or young journalists or people operating without any resources, when they receive a legal letter for the first time, and they speak to their partners about what the implications are of carrying on doing what they're doing, they realise that they could be losing their livelihood and their house and their reputation and be in debt for the rest of their lives. And so they quietly decide to do something else. So I think it is a massive problem across society, the ability of rich people to threaten legal action and therefore chill any investigation into their activities, which is why you were being cheered on from the sidelines by so many journalists when you were going after Zahawi, because we were like, yeah, he's going to take the hit if he's wrong. But also fair play to Dan.
I think it was a tactical error for Zahawi, partly because I'm a bad person to sue, partly because then it opened up a channel between me and his lawyers, and I think they clearly wished that I'd just disappear. But I kept writing them letters saying, I plan to say that your clients lied about this and that. And then when I didn't get a reply saying we deny that, but I got a reply with just a kind of form, generic answer, I was sure in my mind that he had lied about it.
I think there's a course to be done, maybe by people like yourself, maybe by defamation lawyers, maybe by the heads of legal at various broadcast organisations, for freelance journalists, along the lines of how to respond to legal threats to the lawyers involved, to bottom out exactly what you think they might be threatening and what you think they might actually be saying in their letters, because sometimes it does boil down to that nuance of phrase that, as you say, not quite answering the question, not quite denying what you're actually asking them, and just over layering it with very aggressive language, which can be, you know, it's surprising. Journalists are quite hard headed, but when you get letters which contain that sort of unnecessarily vehement legal language, or not legal language, it's just sort of threats laid on top of legal language, that can have a a chilling effect, I think. And I think
it's the combination of very clear threats and very unclear factual denials.
Yes, that's exactly that. And learning how to read those letters and respond to them, I think, would be a module in a course all by itself. Right, let's get on.
Let's get on
to the post office scandal. When did this sort of first come across your desk, and what was your initial reaction?
So I've been aware of the post office scandal for quite a while, partly because of your reporting, partly Private Eye. And I think lawyers are particularly outraged by it because it seems such a violation of legal norms, legal standards, legal ethics.
Do you know what? I've never actually asked anyone about this because I think you're echoing something that I've heard many, many times. Is it simply because there is within your profession an understanding that you have to be beyond certain before you start putting criminal charges against someone? You are putting their liberty at risk. You have to know absolutely within your own mind that your client has got their case right.
So I'm not a criminal lawyer in either the Saul Goodman sense or the normal sense. But yes, I think that's right, that you lawyers need to be very careful when they make any accusation against anyone. And if that accusation is criminal in nature, they need to be incredibly careful. And not only was that not done, but when it became reasonably clear that something was up, nothing happened. 10 years or more in which nothing happened. And it's, I lack the vocabulary to express how much of an outrage it is.
So what should your profession have been doing? Because don't forget, and I think we're going to hear this when the senior execs, the board members, start giving evidence in the inquiry. They are going to be saying, we took legal advice from the best qualified silks on this specific area in the entire country. And they came back to us saying, no, you're doing everything absolutely right. There might be a few cases where you may need to send a few letters, but you know, there's nothing that you really need to sort of... you don't need to start pulling up trees and telling Parliament about this. And this went all the way to the very top. You had Grabner, you had Neuberger.
But who was getting advice and what questions were they asking? If it was the three executives who gave the on-the-record, off-the-record briefing to Panorama, you can imagine that the QCs were getting an incredibly incomplete picture of what was going on. Now, Richard Moorhead, Professor of Ethics at Exeter University, has written extensively about this, and he queries whether the QC should have been as ready as they were to accept some of the assertions that were made to them. But it is, and I'm not as familiar with the detail as him, it's not my area as well, so I'm not really going to comment, but I think it is often, legal advice is often used as a smokescreen. We're familiar in public with pressure groups or governments, indeed, pulling out triumphantly a QC or KC opinion and say, look, this eminent lawyer says what we're doing is fine. Great. Now can I see the terms on which he was instructed, please? What did you tell him? What did you tell him about the facts? What did you tell him about the law? Did you put both sides to him? Or was it essentially, we think black is white, trust us on this, please don't go into whether black is white, now please give us advice on how dark a shade of white we have here.
And I think, again, that is something that you would imagine will be looked at, or hopefully will be looked at. I'm not quite sure how much the lawyers are going to come in for a scrutiny over the course of the inquiry. But there is a general feeling within your profession that something very, very badly went wrong over a long, long period of time. So I'll take you back to my question without trying to frame it for you. What should have been done? What should people have been doing within your profession to stop this? Because I think there is a certain amount of soul searching going on within the legal profession as to how culpable lawyers in general might have been in prolonging it.
Well, and again, not my area, and So I'm hesitant to be too definitive, but I would think the in-house lawyers at the post office who are responsible for prosecutions, when those Private Eye and Computer Weekly pieces first came out, they should have spent every waking moment of their lives checking if the stories were correct, and if they found even a scintilla of truth in those stories, undoing what they'd done. And they didn't.
So So you were aware of the story, you'd read about it in private eye, you'd seen bits and bobs in the media, and then the compensation schemes which have sprung up around it came into your purview. What prompted you to look into the tax implications of those schemes?
So there was a story in the Mail, the Daily Mail, about compensation, looking expressly at expressly the amount of tax that was being paid.
Is this about this 80-year-old gentleman who had found that most of his settlement was going to be taken away by his bankruptcy trustees?
Francis Duff. And yes. I know Tom Witherow, the Daily Mail's political respondent, who wrote up the story. And I know that he's a very good, very, very reliable journalist. And so I read the story with interest, saw the tax thing and thought, aha, in a sense, it was a way for me to write about an element of this scandal that had appalled me for so long. I really try and stay in my lane and only talk about tax. I think it's dangerous for someone who's an expert in one area to suddenly think they're an expert in everything. I really try hard not to do that. But if there's an area that interests me and I see a tax angle, I will pick it up. And so that's what I did here.
We perhaps ought to explain for people who might be unfamiliar with this that there are now four compensation schemes currently running in parallel, helping four different groups of people who are affected by the post office scandal. You have two run by the government. They're the overturned historical conviction scheme and the GLO scheme, which is for people who were part of the civil litigation which blew open this whole scandal, which concluded in 2019. And you have two schemes run by the post office. You've got the historical shortfall scheme, which was actually set up as part of the civil litigation settlement for people who weren't involved in the group litigation, but who may have found themselves suspended, sacked, or forced to pay back money to the post office because of problems with the Horizon IT system. And you also have the suspension pay scheme, which is the newest scheme set up for people who were suspended without pay, which obviously was massively disadvantageous to the business, which the post office was allowed to do under the terms of the sub-postmaster contract, but which in 2019, Mr. Justice Fraser ruled was unfair. As far as
and
I understand,
how outrageous it is that they had to go and get a ruling on that.
Well, that was the whole thing. This whole scandal would, I think, possibly have been papered over were it not for the fact that those 500 heroes led by Alan Bates managed to raise the millions of pounds needed to go and take on the post office in the High Court. And everything has flowed from there, including the overturned convictions. But I think I'm right in saying, and I think there's a sort of statutory instrument that's been laid before Parliament, that the overturned historical conviction scheme and the GLO scheme will pay compensation essentially exempt of tax. Now,
yes,
I'm probably getting a little bit ahead of myself because Tom Francis is in the HSS scheme. Francis Duff is in the HSS scheme.
Yes.
He was the one who caught your attention due to Tom Witherow's article. And then what did you do about it? You had a look at how much tax he was paying and thought, this is wrong.
Mr. Duff very kindly provided through Tom to me a copy of the settlement. And I looked at that. Now, these are areas, tax treatment of compensation for individuals, is not an area where I have personal expertise. Fortunately, I know a large number of tax people and I can draw on their expertise, and they very generously provide it free. So in particular, there's a retired HMRC inspector called Ray McCann. There's probably the leading direct tax academic, Judith Friedman. And there's also a retired senior tax accountant who wishes to be anonymous. And the three of them provided help on this together with a few others.
And your fundamental conclusion was what?
Right, so there were several problems here. First problem is, say you've got a postmaster receiving £30,000 of income a year. They're going to pay about £5,000 tax on that. If they're getting compensated for 10 years of lost income, that's a lump sum payment of £300,000. You might think there will be 5 times 10, £50,000 tax on that. But no, there'll be a lot more, because if you earn £300,000 in 1 year, you're catapulted into a much higher tax bracket. So what's the difference between that and if you'd been paid over 10 years? Well, it's an extra £80,000 tax, more or less.
Now, if I'd received a compensation payment like that, I'd go to my accountant and say, is there any way that I can be taxed on this over a period of years? Can you go to HMRC?
I think you wouldn't, actually. I think probably you wouldn't. Probably what you'd do is you'd discuss it with your tax accountant before you sign the settlement. Your accountant would say to you, post office should be increasing the compensation they're paying you. in order to cover the additional tax. That's how settlements always work. It's called the Gourley principle. It's very well established.
So could you tell me about that? Because I must admit, not knowing anything about the world of tax, that one took me by surprise, that when you are calculating compensation payments, you should be, what, trying to overpay so that you're cancelling the tax liabilities?
Well, the point of financial compensation is that you're putting someone in the same position they would have been if you hadn't wronged them. So that needs to take account of everything, and in particular it needs to take account of the tax that you're paying. If you've lost 10 quid and I pay you 10 quid compensation, but 5 quid is taxed, you're ending up with 5 quid. You haven't actually been properly compensated. So this principle is a fancy name, the Gourley principle, but it's kind of common sense.
And it exists, and you said it's well established. Why on earth wasn't it part of the thinking for the historical shortfall scheme?
Don't know. We know why the tax advisers to the victims didn't spot this, because they didn't exist. Because whilst the post office just about agrees to pay a small amount towards victims' legal costs, they don't provide anything for tax advice. So that's why the victims didn't know. Why didn't the post office and their lawyers spot this incredibly obvious point that took my team about 5 minutes to spot? Don't know.
But I mean, you said it's a well-established principle. It's the Gourley principle. It is presumably referred to in case law. Therefore, why wasn't it part of the legal thinking by whichever lawyers advised the post office on setting up the historical shortfall scheme, who I think are Herbert Smith Freehills? Is this bad faith? Or is this just incompetence?
We can just speculate. Part of it could be the post office was doing this on a ridiculously tight budget and told Herbert Smith not to provide tax advice. My bet would be that's what happened. I suppose it's also possible Herbert Smith did provide tax advice, spotted the point, but were ignored. I'd be very surprised if Herbert Smith's tax people were engaged and they missed the point. That would amaze me. So I think it's that the post office excluded tax from the scope of Herbert Smith's work.
Well, okay, let's park that for a second. They should have been assessing compensation payments, taking into account that people would have to pay tax on them and therefore bumping up the compensation. You also looked at it from the other end about, as you say, that paying tax on a lump sum, which immediately puts people into a higher tax bracket.
Yeah, they could have done it differently. Probably the best way to do it would be to recognise that this fundamentally isn't about financial loss. Yes, they lost out financially, but these people have lost years of their life. They've suffered the most enormous amounts of stress. This is now years later. They just want it all to go away. These people need compensation for the emotional harm that they suffered, for the stress. They need exemplary damages, sometimes called punitive damages. All of those things could have been paid and wouldn't have been taxed.
Because you only get paid on charged tax on compensation for loss of earnings, is that right?
There's some other things too, but some things are taxable and some aren't. And in this case, a payment of a lump sum compensation for your misery and exemplary and punitive damages, we think wouldn't have been taxed. Now, sometimes it's a bit naughty to try and structure something to pay less tax. Here, I think it would have been entirely just. Very doubtful HMRC would have challenged it.
I think what you were calling for was the government to basically announce that any payments made under any of the four post office compensation schemes would be exempt of tax.
Well, I think that's just, given that the difference between the GLO scheme and someone who's in the GLO scheme and someone who's in this scheme is a matter of kind of luck and timing. And it's hard to see why you should have a different tax treatment of compensation between the different schemes. And I'm pretty confident the government sees that and there will be an exemption. Oh, but we haven't come to the other thing the post office got wrong on this.
Yeah.
Which is perhaps even worse. So because all of this was a long time ago, there's a large amount of interest payable by the post office on the damages. And it's hundreds of thousands of pounds in many of these cases. Now, when you receive interest, that is normally taxable unless there's a special exemption. Some of that tax is withheld. 20% is withheld by the post office, so you get the rest. And you're then responsible.
Almost like PAYE, your tax at source.
Well, it's more like the old days when you had 20% of tax withheld on interest payments in your bank account, because you're still responsible for the rest of the tax. Now, if you're earning several hundred thousand pounds, of interest and other damages. You are going to have more tax. It's going to take the tax on the interest up from that 20% withheld all the way to 40-45%. So what the Post Office settlement should have said is, yeah, we're withholding 20%. You should be aware you're going to have additional tax on this. It's going to be approximately X. You should probably get some tax advice and we'll cover the cost of that. That's what it should have said. Instead, what it says was, we're withholding 20%. You may be entitled to a refund. You should see a tax advisor about refund. It is also possible you have additional tax to pay. We're not providing tax advice. Here's some ways of finding out who an advisor is who can give you tax advice. So someone reading that is not going to realise that, in fact, there is zero prospect of getting a refund and absolute certainty of a large additional tax bill.
So it's misleading advice?
Yeah, the Post Office actively misled them. It was boilerplate text, which is appropriate. If I was paying someone £1,000 of interest and I knew that they're not currently a high rate taxpayer, that would be an appropriate thing to say. But when you're paying someone large amounts of compensation that takes them well into the higher rate tax band, it's simply wrong.
And it's indefensible. It could be that, I mean, don't forget that some of the historical shortfall scheme payments would be less than £5,000. So in that case, the advice might be correct.
Yeah, no, if the total compensation paid is less than £12,700, then that would be appropriate.
But they should have inserted something saying, if you're compensation payment is over X or around X, then it is a dead cert. You will be paying additional tax and you need to seek advice on this.
I mean, it wouldn't have required a brain the size of Einstein to make it specific for cases where you're getting large amounts of compensation for those that are not.
Because, of course, the way it does read for a layperson like me would be going, oh, I might get some more money. Because that's the human bias,
exactly.
Isn't it? To assume optimism.
I might get some more money, but you know, I'm just tired of this. I want it to go away. I'm probably not going to bother and get more money. And that's the danger. The danger is that then they go, they don't get tax advice, they don't file a tax return, they end up in default to HMRC, and for no fault of theirs and no fault of HMRC's, find themselves on the wrong end of HMRC penalties. And that's an unconscionable outcome. And the sole fault there lies with the Post Office.
So you started drafting a thunderous piece for your website, and we started talking whilst I think it was still in the drafting phase. Could you summarise what you eventually published on the Tax Policy Associates website about the Post Office compensation schemes?
So it's really the point we discussed, that the Post Office has stuffed up. The compensation has been poorly structured. They haven't added compensation to cover for the tax. They haven't warned people receiving interest that they're going to be paying more tax. There's a risk these people fall into the fault with HMRC. And the only solution at this point is a government exemption.
What was the response to your article?
The response online was that people immediately got it, and a number of journalists got it, and there have been some follow-up stories. I was asked to write a column for the Times' wonderful Thunderer column on this. The Post Office immediately responded by just sending a complete non sequitur saying they liked unicorns, hugs, bunnies and wanted to treat everyone fairly. They've since come out with something a bit more specific in a letter to the Times today, which says they're working with the government to see if these outcomes are unfair. Yeah, not good enough. It took me and my volunteer team 1 or 2 days to spot the problem. They have now had almost 2 weeks, and these aren't passive tense unfairnesses. These are results of actions by the Post Office. So it would be nice if they acted with a bit more speed and they took a bit more responsibility. But I guess the fact they don't do either is of no news to anyone who's been following this story.
Well, this is what has surprised me about this. And I must admit, I was delighted when I saw your name drop into my email inbox. And I thought, oh, this is really good that someone like you is taking an interest in this story. But even I've been surprised by the speed at which things appear to have moved along since you got involved, because very, very quickly the minister, Kevin Hollenrake, the minister with responsibility for the Post Office, was responding on Twitter to say, oh, we're looking at this, we're having a meeting about this today.
Within like 2 hours. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he clearly was just like everyone else who'd seen it and got it immediately. That's why I'm so confident the government's going to do the right thing, because this is not a subtle point.
No, but for people like me who've been following this story and maybe just asking the wrong questions all the way down the line, the sclerotic nature at which everything appears to move has changed very much. And I ought to express my gratitude to you for getting involved in that regard, because things have moved on very, very quickly. I presume when you were putting together your article, you wrote a note to the post office or some email to the post office saying, look, this is what I'm going to say, or this is what I think is the case. Can you come back to me and set out what your position is? What were your interactions with the post office like?
I don't play that game, Nick. If there are facts that I'm unsure of, I would do that. But I'm certain that my team knows a lot more tax than anyone in the post office does. I'm not going to ask the post office to comment first, when all that will do is slow us down. I will ask them to comment afterwards, because I'm interested to hear how they respond. But I have no interest in their view on the technical tax points, because I'm certain they won't understand them. And this isn't personal arrogance, because these are not points where I have expertise. It's confidence that my team has expertise and confidence the post office doesn't. So I don't have an editor who requires me to put points to them first. And here I thought that would add nothing. I felt throughout that there is an urgency here, because the urgency is that we need to stop people receiving settlements that are misleading and wrong. And we need to stop people making potentially irrevocable decisions with their money because they don't realise they're taxed.
So this was, I think, only 2 weeks ago that you published your piece a bit less than that. Then there was a flurry of activity. The Minister Kevin Hollenrake said we're having a meeting. I must point out
what a searing indictment of this scandal it is that you think that a two week delay that I think of as slow, you, in the context of this scandal, you see as a flurry of activity.
Well, don't forget the last podcast I did was with the son of a 70-year-old sub postmaster who put in an application to the historical shortfall scheme in 2020. And in January 2023, he had not received an offer of compensation. That's the speed at which the post office works.
How hard is this?
Well, this is the question that lay people like me keep asking. I mean, you know, the government has set aside more than £1 billion in compensation for sub-postmasters. The government and the post office have recognised that a wrong has been done to thousands of people. And yet, there are still some people with legitimate claims who haven't even yet received an offer. So you, maybe in that context, you can understand my surprise at the speed things have happened with regard to this. Just to bring people up to date with where we are specifically, we had this letter in the Times from the post office today. Also, I understand that a statutory instrument, or whatever you want to call it, a new law has been laid before Parliament by the government stating that participants to the GLO scheme and the participants to the overturned historical conviction scheme will not have any tax liabilities on any compensation payments. But the suspension pay scheme and the historical shortfall scheme, both operated by the post office, we have not had any clear indication of what the status of tax liabilities of the compensation payments for those schemes will be. And this is really important because of the point that you made. An awful lot of people have already received their compensation and been taxed on it and retained tax liabilities that they may now be thinking, well, am I going to be liable for this or not? What's your understanding of where we are with those two schemes?
Well, we've heard nothing, but the fact that the minister responded so quickly and the fact that it seems unjustifiable to treat two schemes differently from two other schemes means surely there will be an exemption. Surely.
This is where your faith in the system is now surprising me. because
I can't believe that there won't be an exemption.
So what's your understanding of the letter in the Times today, which you highlighted on your Twitter feed?
Sorry, I should just add, for SRA regulatory reasons and for insurance reasons, I don't have insurance, I never provide advice to individuals. And I've kind of broken that rule here. I've said to post office victims under the historic shortfall scheme and under the suspension scheme, I've said, this isn't advice, but it kind of is, don't pay the tax now. Don't take any step now, because I think there will be an exemption.
That's really important. So let's just read out the letter from the post office today because it's the most current thing. This is in response to, this is from Simon Ricalden, who's the historical matters director at the post office. In response to Dan Needle's column in The Thunderer on February the 23rd, both the post office and our shareholder, the Department for Business and Trade, share the principle that the victims of the Horizon IT scandal should be returned to the financial position that they would have been in had they not suffered the wrongs of the past. Together with the government, we are looking at the tax implications so that we can identify whether any unfairness exists, and if so, what action could be taken. So they're still at the point of suggesting that the unfairness that you have highlighted and just been speaking about may not exist.
I don't quite know how to start with this letter. Every sentence of it seems wrong. So in response to my 23rd February column, but hang on, the Daily Mail piece came out on what, the 16th? And my post, which I told them about at the time, came out on what, the 19th? So they're not responding to that letter. They've been aware of this beforehand. Why are they only looking at the implications now? Why didn't they look at it in the past? And why are they putting this in the passive tense as if it's all, the tax law is awfully unfair here? Why aren't they recognising that this is a direct result of the post office's own failings, the fact they didn't pay for tax advice for the victims, the fact they didn't structure the compensation properly, and the fact they included misleading wording about tax on interest? What, again, the post office is walking away from its own responsibility. I'm slightly lost that they're doing this. This principle that victims should be returned to the financial position they would have been in had they not suffered the wrongs of the past. That shouldn't be the principle. If I punch you in the face and that causes you to lose a day's work, I can't just hand you a couple of £50 notes and say, well, you're now in the same financial position you were previously. That's not proper compensation for the wrong that you've suffered. The idea that this is a mere financial transaction and all that's required is mere financial compensation is wrong. It's immoral, and it shows a fundamental lack of understanding what the post office did. Hang on, I'm breaking my rule. I'm talking about something up in tax, but I'm lost here as to why they think that's right.
Obviously, we invited the post office to come in and join this discussion this morning. And for students of my history of trying to get the post office to do an interview, won't be surprised to know that they declined the opportunity. No one was available. So Sam Steen, KC, said last year in one of the open hearings, compensation hearings, which the statutory inquiry had set up to look into matters such as this, that the historical shortfall scheme in particular was in danger of becoming a scandal within a scandal. I don't think he was talking about tax then. I'm pretty sure he wasn't. He was talking about the way that the compensation payments were being assessed. What now needs to happen? We've already had Sir Wynne Williams in his statement of January 23 saying that if he was involved in the historical shortfall scheme, he certainly wouldn't have started from here. We do have this situation whereby people are being, it seems, given under-assessed payments or offers of compensation, and there is a mess around the tax liabilities on them. What happens now?
So the hard way that it happens is that the settlements are all reviewed and adjusted to properly deal with tax, taking more time, taking more away from the limited life available to many of the quite elderly victims.
But is that what should be done?
No, let's not do that. Let's have a simple government exemption, first point. Second point, the post office must pay for the... It won't need to pay for tax advice going forward to people who receive settlements if it's exempt, because the tax advice is there is no tax. The settlement should say that clearly. But the post office does need to pay for tax advice for people who've already received settlements so that they can reclaim the tax which they would have overpaid because of the exemption.
And what about the fact that the settlement offers were not made in accordance with the Gordy principle? Doesn't this leave the post office open to litigation?
If we're creating a tax exemption, that doesn't matter anymore.
Simply because, therefore, there is no danger of anyone
There's no tax. But we do need, because I now don't trust the post office at all, we need another statutory rule, which is that the post office must not be reducing any of the compensation it's paying because it knows there's a tax exemption. In other words, back to my example of someone who was earning 30 grand a year on which they paid 5 grand tax, HMRC, the post office might now say, aha, the lump sum we're paying you isn't taxed at all. So we don't need to pay you 10 years of £30,000. We'll pay you the lesser amount of 10 years times your after-tax amount of £25,000. They could use the exemption to reduce the payments. There needs to be a statutory rule to stop that happening because it is unfair. The post office gets to benefit from the exemption, and it's also unfair as between different victims, those who've been paid in the past and those who are paid in the future.
So all eyes essentially on Minister Hollenrake and his officials at the Department for Business.
Yes.
As to what they do now. As I say, we've got this sort of 23rd of February, what looks like a statutory instrument, which actually encompasses the infected blood scheme and the other two post office schemes saying no tax will be paid on any of these settlements. You need that updated or a separate one put in place for the suspension pay scheme and the historical shortfall scheme.
Exactly.
And then everyone, and then you can walk away from this, Dan, job done.
Well, my role in this is very limited. People like you and the Computer Weekly and the Private Eye guys are the people who really did the running on this. I have a small walk-on part and I'm doing what I can, but ultimately there's much bigger questions that have nothing to do with tax.
That was Dan Needle talking to my co-host Nick Wallace. There are several links in the podcast description for all the pieces mentioned. So Tom Witherow's Daily Mail piece, which prompted Dan's interest, Dan's original piece for his own website, the proposed legislation exempting two of the compensation schemes from tax, and Dan's Times piece. A big thank you to Dan for his time. Nick and I are still keeping an eye on this phase of the Post Office Horizon IT inquiry, which concludes its latest stint at the end of next week. We are hoping to put together an episode summarising this batch of evidence when the 3-week stretch is over. This podcast is entirely financed by your crowdfunding donations. If you can spare us the price of a coffee or a pint, please go to the donate page on the Post Office Scandal website. You will find a link in the description to this episode, or you can go straight to postofficescandal.uk/donate. You'll be signed up to Nick's secret email newsletter, which collates everything going on at the inquiry and the wider scandal. Investigating the Post Office Scandal is produced and presented by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace, with advice and support from Whistledown Productions. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.